Hello and welcome to Sublime Insights. I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence, and we're recording this from a very wet and windy central London on Friday the 17th of March 2023. On this episode, Sydney Stewart will be talking to us about the recent collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. We will be joined by Leila Guest to discuss Moldova, and Rhiannon Phillips will join us to talk about the recent rapprochement in relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And as ever, if you do have any questions or you wish to reach out to us at Sublime, please refer to the email address in the show notes and do remember to like and subscribe. So, Sydney, welcome back once again to the podcast. A really timely topic we're talking about today. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank has been widely publicized. Today, we're going to talk about maybe some implications and some going to look into some forecasting as well. But for those who haven't been up to speed with what's been going on, can you just put us in the picture what happened over the last week or two with SVB?
Sure. So it has been a riotous week in the US. On the 10th of March, so just about a week ago from when we're speaking now, Silicon Valley Bank effectively collapsed and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp assumed control of the bank in order to enact also extraordinary measures to shore up confidence in the U.S. banking system. And SVB's collapse actually marked the second largest banking failure in U.S. history. So it was, you know, quite a significant event that actually stemmed from a mid-sized regional bank with a very, very highly concentrated, you know, client base in the tech sector primarily. The bank is responsible for backing an extremely, extremely high proportion of tech and life sciences startups in the US. So there was a really crisis concentrated heavily in that sector.
Thank you, Sydney. And as you say, very, very turbulent week indeed. What has the reaction been broadly in the financial sector? There's lots of talk of contagion. We've obviously seen Credit Suisse affected. What's been the overall reaction and how worried are you?
So indeed, following the collapse of SVB, the markets reacted with quite some volatility over concerns that other small and medium-sized banks faced similar liquidity constraints that would also possibly prompt them to collapse. This includes First Republic, Comerica, Western Alliance, Zions Bank, and some others, which also had their ratings downgraded by Moody's over those concerns that the lender's reliance on uninsured deposit funding left them in a pretty vulnerable position. Stocks for those regional banks actually tanked into corrections territory on Monday and had their stocks, the trading of their stocks suspended. However, in fact, just yesterday on the 16th of March, several major Wall Street banks announced that they would step in to prop up First Republic, which is, you know, the secondary bank that was expected potentially to collapse after SVB. Those firms will step in with USD 30 billion to prop up First Republic, which will prevent its near-term risk of collapse. So this is, you know, a positive development that mitigates that kind of near-term systemic risk. However, you know, questions do remain. Of course, you mentioned Credit Suisse earlier this week. It looks like a real possibility that Credit Suisse could face also collapse as, you know, general uncertainty in the market really, you know, seized upon them. They were the only kind of major bank that faced similar kind of fears of collapse. In fact, other major U.S. Financial institutions actually reported above average cash intakes because people were shifting their money from the smaller mid-sized banks into bigger, safer banks, or at least perceived safer banks. So, but Credit Suisse's vulnerability was effectively, you know, the product of a history of recent management failures and, you know, poor risk management.
So quite a turbulent reaction, it seems, in the short term. Certainly some institutions getting found out as the interest rates kind of return to normal, I guess, after well over a decade of historically low rates. And a bank with some reputation in Credit Suisse potentially being affected. Before we get onto the kind of long term, now many of our clients and our listeners will be in sectors that have invested or put their money with SVB and similar banks. Indeed, many of our clients will have vendors and third party suppliers and those in their supply chain which have also invested their money with SVB. What are the client implications as far as we can tell at the moment?
So this kind of bout of market volatility and the collapse of SVB has precipitated a lot of discussion in Washington about the necessary policy action in order to mitigate the risk of similar incidents in future. So it's highly likely that Congress will revisit aspects of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, which was, of course, implemented following the 2008 financial crisis, because certain measures actually were repealed in 2018 that reduced the risk threshold at which point banks were subjected to additional oversight and reporting. So specifically, the Dodd-Frank Act initially in 2010 said that any bank valued at $50 billion in assets would need to be subject to greater oversight. However, in 2018, Congress actually shifted that threshold to $250 billion, which left many mid-sized banks without enhanced oversight. This includes SVB, whose assets were worth $209 billion at the end of last year. So, in fact, they fell just shy of that oversight threshold. So, this is definitely something that lawmakers are going to revisit.
Certainly, that's really interesting. So we've had, maybe some questionable management decisions, a lack of oversight, historic economic conditions with very low interest rates, over the last, 10, 15 years, all creating, I think, a perfect storm. I mean, it seems, just to finish, Sydney, that we've avoided complete disaster in the short term. Would you agree with that, or would you raise any red flags for us to look out for in the future?
Certainly, I would say that short-term systemic risk has been mitigated, especially with the news that a major Wall Street banks will step in to prop up regional banks, and of course, the decision by the Swiss National Authority that they will prop up also Credit Suisse. So effectively, they're looking in decent shape for the moment, but there will be sustained reputational risks as well that will extend into the medium term. I think there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on both the kind of intersection of the tech sector and the financial sector in Silicon Valley. And we might see also tech firms and adjacent organizations coming under pressure for their associations with the crisis. But it looks like we've headed off imminent disaster. Although, I've spoken with a friend of mine who was a trader and she was very doomsday about the whole thing a few days ago, and the markets move fast. So, yet to be seen, but I would definitely say short-term market implications were in a good place.
Well, Sydney, thank you very much. I know your desk produced an excellent update brief on this very topic just a few days ago, and we'll be looking forward to further reporting. I know you'll keep a sharp eye on this. But for now, Sydney Stewart, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Gareth.
Okay, and a warm welcome to Leila Guest. First time on the podcast, Leila, a really warm welcome, and really glad that you could join us today. And we're going to talk about Moldova. The Eurasia desk at Sibylline has pushed out a lot of reports in recent weeks on Moldova, of course, in the context of the war in Ukraine. Can you just very briefly summarize what you've been putting out in the last few weeks? What is going on in Moldova for those folks who are unfamiliar?
Hi, Gareth. Thank you for your very warm welcome. So, Moldova at the moment is obviously a very hot topic. So, what we've been seeing recently is increased pro-Russian protests across Moldova and increasing Russian destabilization efforts. So, to give some context, on the 9th of February, Volodymyr Zelensky sent Maia Sandu intelligence, Russian intelligence that was intercepted, stating that there was a Russian coup plot attempt to overturn her pro-European government. And the day after, the then Prime Minister, Natalia Gavrilina, she resigned, citing the crises caused by Russian aggression and their effect on Moldova. So ultimately, what we have seen throughout February into present is increasing Russian protests and Russian destabilization efforts. Most noticeably, what we've seen this week is a leaked Kremlin internal strategy. Now, we can't independently verify this, but if it's to be believed, essentially it marks out Moscow's plans for Moldova right up until 2030, breaking down into the political, military, and defense sectors, as well as trade and economics and the humanitarian sector. And by 2030, to put it shortly, Moscow envisions Moldovan elites being pro-Russian in terms of their economic and political policy. So it shows that Moscow really is in for the long game here in Moldova.
Right, well, that's really interesting, Leila. So we have, to start with, we have Ukrainian intelligence presumably picking up some kind of intercept or source reporting from Russia that Russia was going to try and, you know, orchestrate this coup in Moldova. That intelligence that the Ukrainians gathered was passed to the Moldovan authorities. There was a resignation. That intelligence has been almost borne out and corroborated by the Russian protest activity inside Moldova. And now we got this leaked document, which takes us right back to the beginning and kind of lays out the strategy. It could be, if it wasn't so prescient, it could be a spy movie. But you did say something quite important there, about the protests, and I want to drill in on that. What are we seeing in terms of protests at the moment, and what risks does it pose for folks operating in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing lots of very interesting things with these protests. The pro-Russian Shore Party, fundamentally, which is one of the main driving, if not the main driving force of these protests, they are calling on the government to pay energy bills. Now, obviously, since the war in Ukraine, Moldova's energy bills, like most places in the world, have also rocketed. And due to pensions being so low in Moldova, and just in general, Moldova, unfortunately, does not have the best economic outlook at present. This has really affected people and the way they live. So they're demanding for the government to pay people's energy bills and protesting really against socioeconomic conditions. And we've also seen protests relating to a recent language law bill, which was approved yesterday in its final reading, to refer to the state language as Romanian as opposed to Moldovan, which has also gained some protests and dissatisfaction in parliament from the bloc of communists and socialists. So very interesting here that we're seeing the protests relating to, I suppose, the language and the national question of Moldova and whether it wants to break away from the Soviet language references of Moldovan to align more with Romanian, its neighbour, and also EU and NATO member.
That's extremely interesting. I mean, one or two very quick things. First of all, clients will be interested if the protests are likely to continue, or indeed if the Russian stabilization efforts will continue in the short and medium term. Very briefly, what are your thoughts on that?
These will definitely last, the protests. I don't see these going away, because as long as the socioeconomic conditions are as dire as they are, the pro-Russian Shore Party will leverage on that. And Russian operational operatives will cling on to issues such as the language law and put more pressure on the government to resign, or to, I don't know, increase essentially threats towards Moldova in the form of bomb scares, terror attacks. So this will all have implications on the ground. The protests themselves will have implications as such. So to blocking of roads in Chisinau, for example. So there's real implications there for strategy of transport, and also in general, the whole security dynamic in Moldova is looking quite bleak at the moment.
So clients should really look at our own reporting to make an assessment of the operating environment in Moldova, which seems at the moment challenging. I want to finish with something that happened earlier this week that I know our listeners will want to hear your thoughts on. Before I do, we get this all the time on our bi-weekly Ukrainian webcast, the possibility of Russia invading Moldova in the short or even medium term. Not quite a yes, no question, but can you briefly give us your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. And I can completely understand where these concerns are coming from. We really do not want to see Russia invade another country as brutally as it has Ukraine. I and my desk are also of the inclination that a Russian invasion into Moldova at present is unlikely. Yes, there are Russian troops, a very, very small amount in Transnistria, and they are predominantly there as a peacekeeping, I say that loosely, mission called the Operational Group of Russian Forces in Transnistria. This contingent is around 1,500, so it's a Russian invasion of Transnistria is really not posing too much of a credible threat to Moldova proper. Logistically as well, it would not be possible, I would say, because if Russia, say, wanted to put in more troops, there's Ukrainian air defense in Odessa, and Moldova being landlocked, it would just be very hard operationally to do. So I think on that front, it's unlikely. And I think also the Kremlin would be weighing up such an option and think, actually, there's still hope to influence decision making in Moldova without resorting to such violent means as invasion, as a recent poll has found that Moldovan society actually has quite a positive outlook still on relations with Russia. So this is a scenario where Russia can achieve its aims, if that is to make Moldova choose to align more so with Russia than with the West. They can do this through hybrid warfare and grey zone capability.
Sure, no, that's really interesting. And not a need to invade if soft power, disinformation and coercion is still a credible pathway. Thank you so much, Leila. Very quickly, because I know we'll get asked about this, before I let you go, we're recording this a few days after we saw Russian jets collide with a US UAV. We've now seen footage being released as well, corroborating the circumstances over the Black Sea. But very quick update on where we are with that as we stand today.
Yeah, absolutely. So Russian media in occupied Crimea has reported that Russia has actually recovered the drone now. And it was apparently off the port of Sevastopol at a port at a point of about 3,000 feet in the water. So a depth of that, which, yeah, so somehow they've managed to beat the Americans to getting this drone back. Nikolai Patrushev, the security secretary of the Kremlin's Security Council, did say that it was Russia's mission to retrieve this drone. So it comes as no surprise that they have actually gone, if these reports are to be believed, and retrieved the drone. I suppose people would be thinking the implications of Russia getting this drone. I know John Kirby has said that, you know, they would try to minimalize the potential security risks if Russia were to get their hands on it first. So I think we shouldn't worry too much about any information that Russia can potentially get from this drone, as it seems to be like there are efforts to mitigate this or minimalize this from Washington. I also don't think this is going to spur into a major escalation with Moscow and Washington, given that this incident happened on Tuesday and things are relatively calm. And I know Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the US, did say that it was a provocation, but we are yet to see a major escalation so far. So hopefully it remains as such.
Okay, Leila, thank you so much for that update and the insight on Moldova as well. I know two topics that we'll be keeping a close eye on, Moldova in particular. And thank you again for coming on the Civiline Insights podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Gareth.
And finally, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Rhiannon Phillips. Rhiannon will be talking about all things Iran and Saudi. Rhiannon, great to have you on board. We've seen recently at your desk reporting on a very significant development in Iranian-Saudi relationships, the rapprochement. And we'd like to go into a little bit more depth today, also about your forecasting and your insights into how the relationship may pan out. However, this rapprochement has come after, you know, several years of severed ties. And I'd just like you to put us in the picture how the relationship disintegrated the way it did prior to this recent development.
Hi, Gareth. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Indeed, you know, it's worth noting this rapprochement took not only kind of regional actors, but also international actors by surprise after, you know, years of kind of severed ties. And these hostilities really date back to kind of prior to kind of 80s. There are deep ideological divisions between Saudi Arabia and Iran that have persisted. And ultimately, what we've seen this amount to, obviously it reached a head in 2016 with the official severing of diplomatic ties with the assassination of quite a prominent Shia cleric in Saudi. But we've also seen this materialize into kind of low-level attacks and hostilities in the form of kind of cyber attacks and you know, drone attacks on critical infrastructure. So this has not only been kind of a rhetorical you know, relationship of hostility, but also has materialized into kind of physical forms of hostility as well. And ultimately, you know, your question, what is at the center of these severed ties? What we've seen is you know, two states which are really seeking to put themselves at the forefront of kind of regional power. And we have, you know, not only ideological divisions, but also kind of economic competition as well in the region. And ultimately, you know, what Iran have stated is that it's their hatred of kind of a perceived Saudi imperialism and the influence of the West that kind of Saudi have experienced as well and enjoyed.
So what you describe there seems to me to be real hostility between two parties. How did we get to the place where we are now? What's led up to this thawing of the relationship?
Yeah, so this is kind of, you know, it's actually, as much as these talks very much took people by surprise, and the fact that, you know, there was an agreement actually reached, this has, as you noted previously, been kind of years in the making. And, you know, specifically, we've seen 6 months of quite intensive talks taking place between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And this is kind of after six attempts of failed talking. So they've basically, you know, ultimately recognize potentially that there's more to be gained by signing this agreement. You know, they're both situated in quite a hostile and rapidly shifting region. And ultimately what we can see is that this is entirely strategic and that there's kind of more to be gained at coming to some sort of a agreement between these hostilities rather than kind of continuing along the current trajectory that they're going towards. And we've also seen with that, you know, a shift in their own foreign policies, which may complement this kind of signing of an agreement and the normalization of ties. So whether that's kind of less support materially from kind of Saudi towards, you know, the Syrian opposition, etc., you know, their goals and their ambitions and drive for the region may actually be different to what it was kind of a decade or so ago.
Okay, so it's been quite a while in the making, you'd say. What are the details of the agreement? Do we know any of the details of the rapprochement at the moment?
So the details are very thin. It's worth noting that the agreement has been, you know, the details of the agreement have been kept almost entirely secretive from the international community. And, you know, this goes for kind of high level intelligence agencies outside of Iran and Saudi as well. We understand that kind of the US and neighboring actors also know very little about this agreement. It's almost as if we're being drip-fed information. So we're seeing stories come out, you know, every day of elements of the agreement that they want to stick to or, you know, issues. But ultimately, yes, very little is known other than basically the two states want to set up or reopen embassies and diplomatic missions in the next 2 months, so effectively before June. But other than that, you know, we're seeing a lot of emphasis on the establishment of economic ties between the states. But no, unfortunately, I can't give you more because the details aren't actually there or readily available at the moment.
And you mentioned China. Obviously, some mainstream media sources, that's very much been the angle to which this has been reported. The brokering of this deal by Beijing. What's the significance and or impact of China being involved in this?
It is definitely significant that, you know, this was brokered by Wang Yi. So this is the most senior diplomat in the CCP, the kind of Chinese ruling party. And ultimately, we can see it as being kind of indicative of China's growing role as a global party and specifically seeking to kind of increase its foothold in the Middle East. This is, again, strategic. I think it's worth noting, and one thing that I would say throughout this whole process is for all parties that this is strategic. It is benefiting national interests, notably kind of China's own economic and, you know, security ambitions that it kind of has put forward. It's basically, you know, part of its efforts to enhance its kind of access to key resources and local markets, particularly in the Gulf. And, you know, this has kind of been matched by strategic agreements to bolster its influence as well. I think it's really important as well to notice and kind of acknowledge mutual agreements of non-interference that, you know, China, Iran and Saudi have all kind of put forward and presented. So ultimately, we saw, you know, Chinese president visit to Saudi Arabia in December 2022. And what they, you know, what they took from this was really that they criticized and had a mutual kind of understanding that non-interference should be a critical part of kind of bilateral ties, which we haven't seen with Western partners. And they've kind of, that's been a real area of mistrust with Western partners. So I guess, you know, another part of your question saying what's the impact of kind of Chinese mediation, et cetera. This is also critical. It reflects a wider disillusion of potential US partnerships in the region. And this isn't new. This is something that we have been seeing, you know, Saudi criticize the US and the West for, notably, you know, an increased disengagement, whether that's militarily. So we look at Afghanistan and Iraq. And so they, you know, they have this growing mistrust and they perceive China to be more of a reliable kind of guarantor in that way. But on that note, I think it's important to note that, you know, the US will remain a primary security and economic guarantor, I think, in at least the short term.
That's really very interesting. And you know, a lot has been made in media outlets about the potential impacts of this deal sticking, you know, be they economic opportunities for both parties, you know, the subject of proxy forces and regional stability and security benefits. However, what do you think are the chances of this deal actually sticking, this actually working? And if it does unravel, what are the implications, Rhiannon?
Yeah, I think it's important not to understate how much of a significant geopolitical development this is. Ultimately, you know, I do want to have an element of cautious optimism that this deal is going to kind of stick in whatever form. But, you know, there is still this real deep-rooted mistrust of each other. You know, we can't get away from the fact that ultimately Iran and Saudi Arabia don't trust each other and don't like each other and haven't for kind of decades. And so we've already seen, you know, in the aftermath of the agreement being signed on the 10th of March, we've already seen Saudi foreign ministers and high-level officials come out and say that there are still massive disagreements and ideological divisions. So the fact that this is being said almost immediately kind of after the deal was agreed, I think is definitely something to look at. In terms of kind of the impacts of the deal sticking, we have a very interesting next 2 months to look at. And I think that, you know, as you said, there are definitely kind of conflicts at the forefront of people's minds, namely the Yemen conflict. We know that this is kind of one of the most active and present proxy conflicts that Saudi Arabia and Iran are involved in the region. This is something, you know, we've already said that Iran have said that they won't supply the Houthis with any more equipment, and we've ultimately, you know, this is interesting to look at anyway, because they have always said that they've never supplied equipment, so you know the weight of this is to be decided. But this is in rhetoric and kind of in face are quite significant, and so we are likely, you know, if this sticks, we are likely to see a reduction in, you know, the prevalence of kind of aerial threats for Saudi Arabian businesses and the UAE as well. So in terms of regional stability, you know, these two sides have traditionally supported opposite groups across kind of Lebanon, Iraq and Syria. So there is a real, you know, opportunity for regional stability here if this were to stick. But yeah, ultimately that remains to be seen.
Thank you, Rhiannon. So you are cautiously optimistic. I think we all are. And, you know, readers, our clients and listeners will read our reporting as this unfolds. But very briefly, should this unravel, should this, as I said in the previous question, kind of not go to plan, what are some of the implications to this deal going wrong?
Yeah, so that's a, you know, very realistic possibility ultimately. And for all the positives that I've just said, basically the reverse can happen. So we could have a deepening of proxy conflicts, so an increase in material support if kind of relations do sour. And, you know, this can mean a return to kind of tit for tat attacks on critical and maritime sphere, as we saw kind of back in 2019 in Saudi. So disruptions to kind of the energy sector and kind of wider cyber disruption as well. And ultimately as well, one of the things that we have to look at is, you know, Saudi perspective on a nuclear Iran as well. So those kind of key issues still remain, and whether we'll see Saudi as a facilitator or an obstruction to getting the kind of international nuclear deal that we want. And, you know, just finally, ultimately, one of the things, you know, the implications of this going wrong is whether we see a souring of Iran-Israeli relations as well. If there is a perception that Iran backs away from the deal because it is, you know, upset or disagrees with Israeli integration into the region, then ultimately this can kind of spiral into a bit of a deepening of already existing, it should be worth saying, you know, hostilities between Iran and Israel as well.
So a really complex threat environment then, with nuclear issues, the integration of Israel into the region diplomatically. A lot to look out for, and I'm sure your desk will continue to push out the reporting. And, you know, it's such a geopolitically important topic. I've no doubt we'll touch on it in further special reports and probably our mid-year forecast. So really interesting stuff, Rhiannon. But for now, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And as ever, if you do have any questions or you wish to reach out to us at Sibylline, please refer to the email address in the show notes. And do remember to like and subscribe.